I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my guest today is Australian filmmaker Imogen Thomas. She's here with us today to talk about her new film, Emu Runner, which is going to be premiering at the Toronto International Film Festival. You're going to want to listen into the interview. The conversation, we went deep. We touched on a lot of different subjects. We talked about developing relationships and trust and looking for common threads, and how so often reality doesn't really align with our experience. And we touched on this thing called social realism in film and nonverbal language, legacies of the past, indigenous Australian rights, and how they're sort of connected to a more global understanding of what it means to understand others and come alongside others in a new, meaning relevant and relevant way. You're going to find out how important it is to be careful not to alienate people when you're telling a story. Imogen is passionate. She's committed to the story, to the film, to changing the way we think about things. For her, I think film is about a conversation. It's about asking new questions and about being respectful in so many different ways. You're going to love the film. It's beautiful. It's charming. It's real. It will draw you in. Emu Runner world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival. And don't forget, on face2facelive.ca, so many more interviews. We're diving in deep with the festival this year. There's going to be a lot coming up. And also, davidpecklive.com for more information about some of the work that I'm doing, the writing and the speaking. And of course, if you want to come alongside face-to-face, you can do that through patreon.com and support us there. And please, if you can do nothing else, I would so appreciate a review on iTunes, and obviously would appreciate a positive review. If you like the podcast, if you're enjoying what's going on here, please leave us a few stars and a comment or two. Don't touch that dial. Imogen Thomas coming right up, talking about her new film premiering at the Toronto International Film Festival, Emu Runner.
Well, welcome to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today. Here with us all the way from Australia is Imogen Thomas, filmmaker, writer, creator, to talk about her new film, Emu Runner. Imogen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
So this is the world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival for, I think, as you said, just before we had the tape rolling, this little, maybe important story that needs to be told. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, this little story? This is a little story that you've been working on for about 15 years, I understand.
Well, I've had a relationship with the community for 15 years, I suppose all projects take a certain amount of time to develop, and
right.
It's also about developing relationships. And so it's 15 years in the making, in the sense of, you know, these are long-term relationships I have. And I think that has allowed me to build trust and given me also the opportunity to sit and observe and have those conversations over time and start to see sort of common threads that are quite important in this community that need to be sort of spoken about.
So did this...
And this community is, if you could imagine, it's from the main city of Sydney, is about 815 kilometres from Sydney, so about 600 miles. So it's right. quite a distance. It's a very remote little community in northeastern New South Wales.
And I'm going to try to pronounce it, Brewarrina?
Correct, Brewarrina.
Oh, come on. Did I get it? Was I close?
Yes, you're very close.
That's excellent. That's good news. So did you visit the community? Did your car break down and then you said, "Wow, this is marvelous. I started to see these extraordinary things and I need to tell this story?" Or was it what was the catalyst that this film grew out of?
I was approached by a non-for-profit organization in Sydney,
okay.
and they proposed an idea of an arts project in this community, and I'd never been to this community, and it intrigued me. And my partner also, Victor Evatt, is an early childhood teacher and psychologist, and
okay.
he was also doing work in the region with fellow colleagues in that area. So at the time I had a toddler, and we just sort of bundled ourselves into a car and set off to undertake this project. But I think the reality of it is when you get on the ground, often those ideas and that you have, aren't necessarily aligned to the realities of people's lives that you meet.
Mm.
So, where my contact point was a women's shelter called Arganya. And very quickly, I discovered that actually maybe the things that I could offer this community at that point wasn't really being a filmmaker. I had to roll up my sleeves
right.
and make cups of tea and be useful and pragmatic
right.
and in that sort of way for the next 3 weeks. That's how it sort of evolved.
And I guess I guess because of your colonial roots, making a cup of tea is pretty high on that list, right?
Yes, a cup of tea, whatever you can do.
That's
hang out
right.
a load of washing. As a mother, you just become very pragmatic on those sort of fundamental needs, like children need something to eat, or you just respond to those very present needs.
Well, you're very...
What I discovered... Yeah.
It's about being, like you just said, the present needs. I mean, it just took me to not only the film, and we're going to talk about that, I'm sure, in a couple of minutes here, but just that meditative simplicity of being in the moment. And I mean, I think that's definitely, for me, it was anyway, a thread throughout this film. And it's about being present. It's about noticing the little things.
Yes, and that is, for me, is just taking in the whole sense of time and this space that this community and this environment offers.
Mm.
And when you do, it's a very subtle and very nuanced, but you can see, such beauty and I suppose a very, in the sense with people, also this sort of non-verbal language that's emerging. You can see this sort of intergenerational sort of trauma written on the next generation, in the next generation. Think legacies of the past are there and present in the people that are living there now too. So yes, but it was very much about being still and doing a lot of listening,
right,
to understand it better.
And is this to you as a filmmaker? Is that a part of? I think I saw that in another interview that you did recently about the film as well, and I think about coming to TIFF and the Toronto Film Festival that being, I can't remember exactly, but it was about being a better storyteller, I think. I mean, maybe synonymously we could say being a better filmmaker is about, it's about listening. I mean, that's about being a better parent, I suppose, too, and a better friend and all those things. But is that a fundamental part of being a great filmmaker?
I think, I had in my second year at film school, we had an exercise which was, to make a documentary, and I was very much a fish out of water. I was in Australia and suddenly found myself in New York, and it was quite a daunting proposition. But I, from that exercise, I took away, one of the key things, which was, it was an observational documentary, and right. Just sitting back and actually allowing yourself to just observe, and I don't mean that in a sort of a spectator, because you alter that environment as soon as you step into it as well.
Sure, yep.
But it's just, I think it's very easy to kind of impose yourself.
Of course.
And you also come with a lot of baggage yourself, which you don't even realize in how you interpret someone's behavior and how you understand their their situation and their set of circumstances. So sometimes you have to put all that aside because you don't realize that kind of curtails your real understanding.
Right.
And you have to be very open. And I think that, for me, I think that brings some universal truths. Once you start to do that, you can start sort of seeing some other things at play that you might not have on your first first engagement, you might not have been able to fully see.
And isn't that one of the things you're really trying to address in this film through the telling of the story about people and about racism and about Indigenous rights all over the world and about the gap and about how we look at poverty and what does it mean and I think it sounds to me like you're sort of talking about some of those things about how we step my background, I don't think I mentioned to you but my background's philosophy, so I'm always interested in asking that next question or a better question or let's get a little more clarity so we can go a little deeper. But isn't that what it's about, those lenses, those filters that sometimes we don't even notice them. And I wonder how do you keep that front and center, not only as a human being, but as a filmmaker, as a storyteller as well?
It's very challenging. I mean, I had to question myself, I'm not Indigenous. Is it really my story to tell?
Right.
But I felt a great struggle in myself as well if I decided not to take that, to be purposeful and
right.
to take my experience and my skills to try and engage with telling a story. So it felt equally as problematic to just walk away and go, actually, that's not my story to tell.
Well, exactly.
Because
exactly,
I felt like
right.
this community was very underrepresented. And the level of sort of, like you said, the social challenges and the level of poverty it's quite arresting,
And where does that as an observer too, and as a storyteller, it's amazing that you were asking yourself those questions, and I'm sure the community kept you on your toes in that sense to keep you very rooted contextually and so on. But where does poetic appreciation come into play, and isn't it the observer's I don't know about job, but isn't there a responsibility to ask deeper questions, to say why are things the way they are? And how is this even possible in a country like this, And I think we're struggling through some of those questions here in Canada for sure. At least some of us are. And I think that's why your film is so, and the story is so leveling. And I think there's so many people that are going to be able to draw something from it. It seems to me.
Well, at the end of the day, I think, this is a story about loss and grief.
Mm.
And we all lose people.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that incredible pain.
Yeah.
We all know how you can feel completely rudderless. You can be, a boat on an ocean and you just don't know what direction to go. And everyone experiences grief very differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that's fundamental to it, that we can connect on that level, because that's just part of our human condition. And then if we can connect on that part, then we can start to, look at the other layers of this particular little girl's story.
Yes.
you know, who's losing her mother, a mother who is very young, which is also something that happens to many Indigenous people, is that life expectancy is cut, you know, their life expectancy is cut short. And, you know, it is. It's a great blight on us that we haven't been able to address this and bridge that gap with the Indigenous community in Australia. And it's something we need to constantly work at and not be complacent about.
I love the performances you get out of these folks. Were any of them professional actors? Were they all just folks that you sort of brought in from outside of the community? I know some of them were, but there was a lot of people that were just community folk that became a part of this film, were they not?
Very much. That was, it was always good. You know, this film was made for the Borana community and with the Borana community. That said, I did find it difficult for some of the roles. The father is played by a professional actor, Wayne Blair, a very experienced actor and also a celebrated director in his own right, an Indigenous director and actor. And then also I brought in the actress that plays the social worker and the police officer, because I felt that was very important, that those external forces on their lives needed to be people that were not from within the community, because I felt that would make it easier to also remind everyone that this is a fictional film.
Right.
It's not a documentary. Everyone's playing a role and a part in a story that we have crafted over many years.
Sure, sure.
And that in itself is quite important, that it is, everyone needs to remember it's fictional.
There's a realism to the film. And, oh, and by the way, Imogen, congratulations on the film and on coming to Toronto. And are you getting excited?
I am getting excited. It has been very overwhelming.
I bet.
You sort of are. You know, a year ago, I was, you know, in the trenches of shooting the film. And I only really completed the film just in August. So it's been an enormously big project for me, and has, you know, consumed me on, you know, every front. But I suppose that's my commitment I made to the community last year, that I said, I'm going to deliver the best possible film I can possibly deliver to you. And that's, you know, I feel like I've met that objective. So that in itself is kind of gratifying.
Well, it's a huge,
that it's
a huge
received
compliment.
By Chief is fantastic. Yeah.
So very rooted in the community, spent a lot of time with them, listening, many years of, I guess, just kind of research, anecdotal, and developing deep friendships, no doubt, and bringing some of these folks into the film, which I think is so wonderful. But I love that stark sense of realism. And one of the things I wrote many notes down, actually, about while I was watching the film, but this idea of the ordinary and the extraordinary, and how, frankly, they're so deeply entwined. And the simplest things, you know, the way we look at them, you know, if we stand back and we actually listen, and we dig deep for that poet in all of us, you know, the scene where she, you know, she's running and she gets the feather, and the animals and the land and the river. I mean, there's just this beauty and wonder around us that we so often miss, right? Because it is so ordinary and yet deeply profound in its own way. And I think that the simplicity of your film and the way you've told the story, I think that really comes out. Was that deeply intentional for you, or is that something that kind of played out as the story, as the film took shape?
I suppose you know, if you go, you know, the idea of social realism. I mean, I think if you could choose, you can all, you've got to decide where you're going to point your camera and what you're going to point your camera at.
Right. Yes.
And you know, it's very you know, it would have been very easy to kind of create a film that was quite, you know, pointed at all the ugliness as well. You know, there is ugliness in every world as well. But I think when I was talking to, when I started this process with Frame Barker, who runs the Indigenous preschool in Brewarrina, one thing that we both agreed is it was really important to challenge those stereotypes that people have about these communities, that they are poor, that they are all run down. You know,
right,
that they're
right.
You know, that they're all these sort of visual stereotypes of these communities. And I really wanted to challenge that and to focus my lens on the extraordinary beauty and the textures and really get the dust on, you know, the audience skin. And
right.
To see things that, you know, even in this landscape, which, you know, we've got a terrible drought at the moment. And when I was shooting the film, it was also incredibly dry. There just hasn't been any rain. And sometimes it does look quite hostile. And but life, the thing that I always find extraordinary is there is this life, be it, you know, a centipede or a beautiful shingleback lizard. And, you know, and it would be, you know, one of the children would be just out shooting. You know, we would be doing some pickups and, you know, this gorgeous little boy, Todd boy, would come and say, oh, you know, holding this lizard up by the tail, said, look what I found. And I'd say, oh, that's just so gorgeous. Let's film it. You know, so I had this sort of little team of, you know, children as well as adults, all just, you know, oh, I saw a mob of emus on, you know, the such and such, the Gadooga Road. You should go and film them, you know. So it was always highlighting the incredible, flora and nature that is also was surrounding me. And I really wanted to celebrate that and to, put it up on a big, or, you know, put it up on the screen because, for me, it really arrests me. It stops me in my tracks and just makes me breathe deeper and contemplate things. And I think we live in such a time where we're, you know, everything's just so fast. There's something beautiful about just slowing everything down a bit. And it's very much like that when I go out there. It runs to a different drumbeat.
Yeah, well,
I really appreciate that.
Well, and it comes through in the film, and I think that's a testament to the storytelling and to the community. I mean, so many wonderful moments, but I think one of my favorites is when Jem, can I call her Jem? When she stoops down, I think she's running, and you the way you shoot this, I guess it's a flat tire, I guess you could say, or it's the what's left of a flat tire on the road, and she steps down and drinks water out of it. I mean, it's just such a gorgeous, beautiful, simple moment. But I love how you say these types of moments stops your breath. Is that what you said? And makes you contemplate.
Yeah.
We need that. We need that. We need that in our storytelling. We need that in our relationships. We need that in our lives, it seems to me. Metaphor, symbol, very strong in the film. I mean, you know, and obviously birds play a very, very big role. And Gemma at one point says, talking about her mother, she says something about how birds told her things. Is this something about the community, the indigenous community that you were trying to sort of tease out for us as a viewer, or were you actually pointing to something else, something you know, ancestral or supernatural, even metaphysical? Is that?
I think it's very much part of the lore of the Nembah people, and this is something that I feel is that there's just a sort of synergy and the connection is so deep
right.
country. And again, for me, it is something just can only be total admiration and respect for this culture. It's just so old. And Weber Warren is positioned in New South Wales. I mean, it has this river that cuts through it, the Barwon River. And it has these very old, they're over 40,000-year-old fish traps.
Wow.
And so it has this, you know, it's a World Heritage listed site. And it's just a very spiritual place.
Mm.
And you can't ignore it.
It's
right. very hard to articulate, but it's this. It seduces you. You feel it, even though you know, colonization has wreaked destruction as well on this culture. These people are incredibly resilient, and they are so connected with their culture, and that's also something that is representational in those sort of links. So her totem animal, her mother, on her mother's side, is the emu in this particular story.
I love how you said that there's such resilience and admiration, and how you can't ignore it. And the something I couldn't ignore about Jem's character is there's a moment where her and her sister, I think, are going to school, maybe, or going out, and one of them's going one way and she's going another, and she says, "I'm going mom's way," and her sister says, "Suit yourself." And I just thought, wow, that is it. This is her. This is her life. She's stepping forward. This is profoundly existential, this film, and its desire to, you know, we live our lives moving forward, right? We step into it, and she's doing that. At this, how old is she? Nine or ten?
And she's actually the little girl. Rae Kai Waite has just turned 12. The character was, but in the film she is meant to be 9 years old.
Like, on one hand you say, how is she ever going to make it? And yet she's making it in every way she can, you know, and how we end with the social worker Heidi, and how she's basically saved her life, right? She comes back anyway, just that sense of determination and commitment and passion in this young woman.
Yes, I think that was the other thing that was very important when I was working with Frayne Barker, about the story we wanted to tell was a story that was, while it touches on, you know, quite harrowing and sad, a sad topic of losing, you know, a significant person in this little girl's life, it was also about showing her as someone who can reconnect and be successful, you know, that she can take that experience and she can find her way through that labyrinth of grief and loss and be a successful and person in her own right. So that was very important for Frayne, that we had a story that was uplifting. And that was also how we wanted to look at the role men played in that.
Right.
So that shaping the role of the father was very important, that he was a very positive and functioning person in the narrative. Not that he was out without his, you know, he's, you know, hot-tempered and...
Right. He's human.
He's not perfect. Yeah, he's human, exactly. That's very much the case.
Human but affectionate and cares. There's a couple of kind of fun scenes that I couldn't help but smiling as a dad of a couple of young kids, where you kind of feel like, I guess the phrase here would be, you're all thumbs, you know, you kind of not quite sure you're doing something the right way, and you feel a little insecure about that, but you got to step into it anyway, because it's really about your family, and that really comes through in this film. And I think that's quite marvelous. I love Imogen, how this film is, you know, you called it a simple story, but on a certain level, I mean, I think it's quite extraordinary. The threads and the themes and the things that the questions that you raise, you know, it's about home and it's about grief and family and about death and community and racism and stereotypes. The list goes on. And is that when you started out, was that the hope? That you would make a film that would sort of challenge the status quo, that might get this conversation going in a new way, or should I say conversations going in a new way?
Conversations. I mean, I think you have to be very careful that you don't alienate people when you're telling a story. And I didn't, you know, in the case of, you know, the social worker and even all those sort of institutions. That kind of, sort of, in many ways, haven't taken the time to really, or the care to, you know, step in the shoes of this
right.
family and this little girl's life, and really probe and pry and understand it from that perspective.
Sure.
And they make some sort of hasty decisions. I didn't want to create this sort of. You know, this binary of, you know,
right,
good versus
right.
bad sort of thing. And because the thing is, the social worker, she's just young and idealistic. And she also has to go through a sort of transformation in this film
as well.
And that was very important that, you know, the film, it touches on these things in a quite, you know, I've tried to be quite sensitive with all those themes I've explored because I don't want to create division, really. I just want people to try and be respectful and just take a little bit more time for others and maybe bring people to the table to have that discussion because I think it's not about us and them. It's about walking together to make things better. And I feel that's been very much a part of my ethos with this project. So for every stage is feeling like a community person or feels empowered by this process.
Right. Yeah.
That they feel like they can make decisions about it just as much as I'm making decisions. So even when, you know, a week out from shooting the film and, you know, I handed all the people in the community a script and a highlighter and they all had a pen and we did our first reading of the script all together at this table and it was the most beautiful afternoon because everyone was sitting there so focused.
Right.
From sort of just after school, Reikai got home and, you know, she got her script and her highlighter and her pen, pencil to make any adjustments just in case, you know, as she would say, I don't say it like that. I wouldn't say it like that. So, it was very important that while we had the framework of a script and everything, everyone also had the opportunity to change and the wording to suit how they needed to say it. And they could also just, own it.
Own it. own it.
Own
it in their own
way. I feel that the ownership is you know, that's very sort of a collective feeling. I feel I'm working for this film in a way. And I work for the community. And that also happened during the editing process. I was very fortunate that Wayne Blair stepped up and said, you know, I'd love to come to the edit suite. And he did. And he gave me an enormous amount of feedback
and guidance
through that process, you know, and that's probably why the edit took me 19 weeks. It was a very, you have to be very thorough.
Right.
Make sure that you've turned over the stone
many
times and in your material that you've really elicited the best performance. And what are you trying to say, you know, with each of those scenes and how it sort of, you know, how does it impact, you know, the bigger picture? And that was very much the case in the last scene between him and the social worker and the police officer, trying to get the intention there, but also not to be didactic.
Right. Well, I it's interesting that you bring that up because that's exactly where I went, and that I don't know if you call it the penultimate scene in the film. I don't think there are those in your film. I think your film is very much about how life kind of just unfolds around us and how we react and how we engage. And so often filmmaking isn't like that. It comes across as very contrived and scripted and so on. And this is about life happening, if that makes, and I think that's that connects to my comment about the ordinary and the extraordinary. But anyway, the line was something to the effect of, he looked at Heidi, the social worker, and he said, I know it wasn't just you. And it's one of my favorite lines in the film because it just reminded me of the presupposition and the assumptions we make and the stereotypes and the things we don't notice, and that we're kind of all complicit in this in some way, aren't we? And
I think so.
Yeah.
We make enormous judgments very quickly. And that's sort of part of, you know, the modern condition we have at the moment. We're having to assess things on such rapid rates that it's not actually looking at the multifaceted nature of, you know, people and situations. We don't have the time.
We don't have the time. Wow.
Yeah, we don't make the time.
Don't make the time. Yeah, that's great. It's so true, I think. Yeah, we live pretty cluttered lives, it seems to me. I have to say, just before, sadly, we're going to have to wrap up the conversation here, but I have to say one of my other favorite lines, other than the fact that Gemma was, Jem was communicating with the emus with it. Was that a tobacco tin she was using?
It was. Yeah. It's an old tobacco tin my grandmother gave me.
It's fantastic.
So everything in the film is, you know, I've totally turned my house upside down. So if, you know, I need a costume, you know, you sort of rifle through your own wardrobe.
Yes,
oh,
right.
Heidi can wear this shirt. You know, wears my partner's boots. And yes, it was an old tobacco.
Wonderful. Well, I just thought that was absolutely brilliant. But I loved Jem's line to Heidi when they're talking about, you know, how, you know, this idealistic social worker, this woman who wants to, and I think she said something about I wanted to make a difference. And I thought that the wisdom of this young girl, this 9-year-old or 10-year-old, she said, you know, she says, couldn't you have made a difference at home? I just thought it just was, talk about insight and wisdom, you know, coming out of this this young girl's mouth. It was just marvelous.
I think that is the marvelous thing about children, is that they just say, you know, a spade is a spade.
That's right.
They just say things very to the point, and they don't have any of these, they just don't mince their words, which I think is something that is incredibly endearing and charming about children and can be quite confronting.
Oh, and there's something about the presence of that, right? About living in the moment and just not even knowing that they don't have time. They're just going to say it no matter what, because this is it. I can't be anything other than authentic, right? And that's something that's just so beautiful about kids. You're right.
And I must say something. You know, I was going back to do some pickups in January in Bawarana, and Ray Kai, who plays Jem. There was a scene where I needed to get a reverse shot of her sitting in the car with her father driving back from the big trip. And I said to her, oh, I really need to get this pickup shot of you. And I was explaining to her. And it was incredibly hot. Summer in Bawarana is crippling. That we arrived, it's like 48 degrees.
Wow.
And we were just all sort of melting. And I was getting this shot at dusk. And
right.
She said to me, I said, so I need you to pretend you sort of, you know, you've been on that big run and, you know, you're really exhausted, and it's just now you can just relax on that car trip home with your father. And she went, and you just fall asleep. And she said, imagine, I can't fall asleep if I'm not asleep. And I said, oh. And she said, I can't pretend. I just can't pretend. And I said, all right, well, maybe you can just relax and just let the landscape that you're driving past wash over you and just take that in that moment.
Right.
Anyway, she said, well, Imogen, you've got one take. And I went, okay. And she was quite a force to reckon with, Ray Kai. And I said to her, I said, okay, well, you know, hop in the seat. We got the car all rigged up with the camera. And we're driving along, and her cousin, Letitia, who plays her sister, was in the back seat as well, you know, sort of assisting, and that was often the case. And I was there with my monitor, and we're driving along, and just the vibrations of the car going up and back down this sort of little dirt road behind town, the motion rocked her to sleep. So it was... because she's spent the whole day in
yeah.
the swimming pool, the Bologna local pool. So there was this kind of, we were all sort of having a quiet little snigger while we were filming this, because Rekai just slowly drifted off to sleep. And the only problem was, you know, her knee would sort of come up, and she had shorts on because it was too hot to wear the leggings. And I'd have to get Letitia to push her knee out of the frame so that it wouldn't be in the frame.
Right.
So, yes, but it's just extraordinary, this little girl. You know, she, you know, after the first week, she said to me, Imogen, you know, thank you for casting me, but this is really, really hard. This is really, really hard making this film. And I said, it is. It's really hard for me as well. But she said, no, it's, you know, it's really hard. And I took that away and really understood that I had to be enormously I had to give her a lot of space for this film because she had a big job ahead of her. Not only just the physicality of making a film and being in predominantly all the, you know, she's in most of the scenes, which is a demand on any actor.
Sure, yeah.
But also just being the bigger role of this, you know, to make her community proud of her. You know, she had to carry that as well, and it's not a little undertaking at all on that front either. And they are very proud of her.
Well, I was going to say they should be proud of her, and I think everyone who sees the film will be too. And I hope you're proud of the film. I think you've made a beautiful film. It's a complex, nuanced, subtle story that has so many things for us to continue talking about. And maybe we'll get another chance to have part two of this conversation. But thank you so much for your time today. I can't believe we've run out of time. But I've been speaking with Imogen Thomas about her new film, Emu Runner, world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival this year. Thank you so much for your time today, Imogen. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, David. It's been a lovely conversation. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.